Let's go tonight to Mark chapter 15. And we're looking at the 10th event of Passion Week, which is the trial of Jesus. We got started into it in chapter 15, and we need to come down now with verse 2 and notice the procedure in the chapter. So let's begin reading in chapter 15, verse 1. Early in the morning, the chief priests with the elders and scribes and whole council, Sanhedrin, immediately held a consultation, binding Jesus. They led him away and delivered him up to Pilate. And Pilate questioned him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" So let's list for ourselves what was the procedure in a Roman court. How were things done? The procedure was as follows. First, there was the reading of the indictment. Notice that in Mark chapter 15, we do not have that, but I'll show it to you in a minute. The reading of the indictment is first. Then, second, the magistrate, Pilate, in this case, assesses evidence and evaluates it, which Pilate does, weighing of evidence. And in the weighing of evidence, two things were considered as prime evidence in the Roman court. Number one was the statement of the defendant. That they valued very, very much. As a matter of fact, if the defendant was in any way reluctant to defend himself, there was a procedure to give him time to come around to his defense. So the words of the defendant were considered. And also the words of witnesses were considered. This is Roman court now. Then the third part was the verdict. And very close with the verdict, so much so that I'll put verdict slash execution. Because they were so close together. Often they went directly from the verdict, if it was in a capital offense and the verdict was death, they did not wait overnight. They did not wait till afternoon. They immediately were turned over to the soldiers and they were marched out to be executed. There was no waiting because there was no appeal. So we might add that. There was no appeal in the Roman court. What the magistrate decided was it. And therefore, since there's no appeal, there's no need to wait. And therefore, the sentence was carried out immediately. With Mark, he will give us a summary statement, and we will be able to get fill-in information from two places. One would be the other gospel accounts, Matthew, Luke, and John, and also what we know about in terms of Roman procedure. So notice that Mark begins with the assessment of evidence. He begins with number two, because in verse two we have Pilate questioned him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" So Mark does not record for us the reading of the indictment. But let's put that in there from Luke 23. Luke 23. Luke 23 is the indictment read. It goes back just a step further. Then Mark picks up. Chapter 23 and verse 2. Verse 1, it says, "Then the whole body of them, that is the Sanhedrin, arose and brought him before Pilate. And they began to accuse him." There is your indictment. "They began to accuse him, saying, 'We have found this man misleading our nation, forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ, a king.' And Pilate asked him, saying," and this is where Mark picks up, "'Are you the king of the Jews?'" So notice Mark omits the indictment, but the indictment basically involved three things. The indictment made by the Jews before Pilate brought up three multiple choices. Number one, he was forbidding paying taxes. He's forbidding the Jews to pay taxes. You can see these would be all slanted in order to get the attention of Rome. Second, he had royal aspirations. And as you well know, Caesar didn't like people with royal aspirations. Caesar was God and Caesar was king, and he would brook no disloyalty. Third was the charge that he was inciting riot. The Jewish people. And we'll not go to them, but those charges are found in Luke 23, 3 through 5. And in that section, you'll note those things. Now, the appeal of them, of course, to Pilate would be the fact that Pilate is responsible as procurator or prefect, responsible for keeping peace in Judea and Jerusalem. And any one of those things could be very, very threatening. In other words, if Pilate allows the Jews to riot, he's in trouble with the Caesar because he's not keeping order. If he allows this man to walk around saying that he is king, then he is allowing competition with Caesar, and that again would be disloyalty. And of course, if he is forbidding the people to pay taxes, then he is forbidding them to support the Roman state. So note, this is all centered and focused about the support of Rome. Well, notice as Pilate asks him that, you come down to verse 2 of Mark 15. Pilate answered him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he said to them, "It is as you say." And the chief priests began to accuse him harshly. And again, at this point in the procedure, the defendant was allowed to respond to these indictments, and Jesus doesn't. And so coming down to verse 4, Pilate was questioning him again, saying, "Do you make no answer? See how many charges they bring against you." In other words, he is expecting him to defend himself. In defending himself, the Romans insisted on your doing that. As a matter of fact, they face the problem of, what if you have a defendant in here that won't speak up for himself? And the procedure for that, coming out of the early martyr trials, was if they refused to defend themselves, they were given three opportunities, three second chances, three third chances to do that. And very often, it was a matter of, "You don't defend yourself, I'm going to give you another chance." And then they would give them a delay, some time to think about it. And then if you were asked again for the second time to defend yourself and said no, you were given more time. And then you were finally given a third chance to defend yourself. So the Romans were very, very big on this kind of trial. And therefore, when Jesus is silent, Pilate is trying to attempt him to answer. Well, at verse 6, Pilate is going to attempt amnesty. Now, we could often read through these verses and say, well, Pilate had a soft spot for Jesus, and he wanted to scourge him and see him released. I don't think we can really interpret verses 6 through 15 this way, because we need to ask two things. Number one, why did Pilate attempt to get Jesus delivered? And second, how did the Jewish population fit into this picture? Verse 6. Question in mind, why did Pilate attempt to get Jesus delivered? At the feast, he used to release for them any one prisoner whom they requested. And the man named Barabbas had been in prison with the insurrectionists who had committed murder in the insurrection. And the multitude went up and began asking him to do as he had been accustomed to do for them. And Pilate answered them, saying, "Do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews?" Now, is Pilate being soft there? If there's one thing we know about Pilate, if Pilate could do anything to show how much he detested Jews, he would do it. So he's not trying to do the Jews any favor. As a matter of fact, the historical records we have about Pilate is that Pilate probably, more than any other, exhibited contempt for the Jews and did contemptible things here. And basically, his viewpoint would be this. I know you Jews, and I know you Sanhedrin. You're jealous. And you want to take his life, and you want me to be your henchman. And Pilate was not about to do any favor like that. The last thing he would want to be would be a pawn of the Sanhedrin. Now, how do we bring the Jewish population into the picture? How do they feel? Pilate hated them, was going to do them no favors, and they returned the favor because they were incensed with the fact that there was a Roman presence in Jerusalem. And therefore, if faced with Are we Jews going to align with Pilate's plan to release Jesus, or are we going to align with the Sanhedrin? And there was no choice involved. They immediately involved the Sanhedrin, and notice you come down to verses 12. After he attempts to release him, you come down to verse 12, and answering again, Pilate was saying to them, "Then what shall I do to him whom you call the King of the Jews?" And they shouted back, "Crucify him." We mentioned in our last study that the Romans had a procedure that could be used in court. And it was simply this. If the public uproar is so much against the verdict of the magistrate, then that protest was called acclamation. And they had what they call the law of acclamation. And the law of acclamation simply said that a magistrate's decision could be reversed by popular opinion. In other words, when they began to cry to crucify him, this is not just a mob action. Pilate is going to have to respond, and if there is enough acclamation for the release of Jesus or for the crucifixion of Jesus, he is under Roman legal obligation to give in. So really, the light that sheds then is not so much that Pilate had the Lord sentenced to crucifixion. But Pilate, in the light of the cries of the Jewish crowd, almost had to do it. Really didn't have that much choice. So what that does is that shifts some of the responsibility anyway away from Pilate and directly on the nation. So that really when we come down to it, who was responsible for the crucifixion of Jesus? The whole Jewish nation. And when we come to the book of Acts, that's who the preachers in the book of Acts hold responsible for the crucifixion of Jesus, namely the whole Jewish nation. Now, treason or insurrection was punishable by three things. We'll simply call it high treason. And that's what Jesus is being accused of. Any one of those accounts, not paying taxes, inciting to riot, having kingly aspirations, any of those had a prescribed remedy under Roman law. One, consignment to the beasts. To be torn apart. If, however, the Roman magistrate felt like that the person who had committed treason was really not that dangerous, they could be exiled to an island somewhere. In other words, if the judge wanted to come down a little bit easy and say, let's not take his life, but we simply want to consign him to a place where he won't bother anyone else, then we will do that. Or the third option was crucifixion. Now, I'd intended to do this a little bit farther on in the lesson, but I think it really fits into the picture right now. So let's talk a little bit about crucifixion. First of all, a little description of a cross. The cross came in two pieces. There was the vertical bar that was placed in the ground, and then there was the transverse piece that went across it. And the custom was basically to take the victim and take the transverse piece. That would be simply the crossbar on the cross. The transverse piece and nail him to that piece. Then the vertical part of the cross would already be planted in the ground. In other words, the picture would be with Jesus carrying the transverse bar. Up here on Golgotha, all prepared before, would be the vertical part of the cross, just like a pole standing there. And then, as they arrived at the cross, the person to be crucified would be nailed onto the transverse piece, and then lifted, and the transverse piece would be attached to the cross. Very often, they use nails in crucifixion. A very interesting piece of archaeology behind that. In June of 1968, was a team of Israeli scholars who discovered a tomb of a person who had been crucified. And in their report, they read as follows. It says, "The feet were joined almost parallel, both transfixed by the same nail at the heels." In their particular case, the nail had actually pierced the, what is that bone? Behind the Achilles, whatever the name of that bone was. So it would be not through the front part of the feet here, but through the, just in front of the Achilles heel, and one spike through both. They had found the nails, the ones discovered in this 1968 were about 5 inches long, that went through the feet. At any rate, the feet were joined almost parallel, both transfixed by the same nail at the heels, with the legs adjacent. The knees were doubled, the right one overlapping the left. The trunk was contorted. The upper limbs were stretched out, each stabbed by a nail in the forearm. We often think of the nails going through the palms, but the one that has been discovered was through the up here farther through the forearm, probably to give a firmer grip. The description then of that's basically what we know about the cross. Another significant thing about the crucifixion or about the cross is, what about its height? The height of a cross had some significance. Normally, the height of a cross was no higher than the stature of a man, just enough that the feet would not touch the ground, so the person on the cross could be reached. Now, if you wanted to, high visibility in the crucifixion, and if you wanted to increase the humiliation, then you would simply increase the height of the cross. Higher cross would put you more up to public view, and being held up to public view, you would have a great deal of humiliation that would be involved in it. There is strong implication that the Lord was crucified on an extraordinarily high cross, which would point out the high visibility and the humiliation they were attempting to bring about. The deduction about that comes, for example, out of Mark 15 and verse 36. And chapter 15, verse 36 says, "Someone ran and filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a reed, and gave him a drink, saying." So notice the soldier has to take the sponge, and he cannot reach his mouth. Normally, you could do that in crucifixion. But this points to the fact that he had to put it on a stick and lift it up to Jesus, would point to a high cross. That would also give force to the words in verse 32. Or the taunt in verse 32, "Let this Christ, the King of Israel, now come down from the cross so we may see and believe." So the height of the cross doubtless was set up in order to give him high visibility and a great deal of humiliation. Third, in crucifixion, what was the cause of death? Now, in the accounts we have, that is variable by two things. Number one, it varies depending on the person's physical condition, obviously. And it also varies on the way they were attached to the cross, whether it was a bloody crucifixion or, in some cases, if they wanted to prolong a death, you weren't nailed to the cross, you were tied to the cross. And thus, maybe last 6 days to a week. As far as the cause of death, exhaustion. Simple exhaustion. Most common cause of death as far as the cross was concerned. Had a couple of statements I thought, and I can't see them right here in front of me, about crucifixion. Crucifixion was one of the cruelest and most degrading forms of punishment ever devised. For example, Cicero, Roman historian and orator, uses the following words. He says, "Crucifixion is the grossest, the cruelest, the most hideous manner of execution ever devised by man. Josephus, in his history, says, quote, "Crucifixion is the most wretched of all ways of dying." We have a word in the English language when we want to see the pain is really unbearable. We take the noun crucifixion and we describe the pain as, give it to me, excruciating. And I know of no word that we can use in English that more fully describes a horrible pain than to say it is excruciating. That is derived from the Roman custom of crucifixion. Yet, as cruel as it was the means of keeping public order in the Roman Empire. And I think I found one of the most interesting statements I've ever read about human expressing human viewpoint. The crucifixion of Jesus was so insignificant from the Roman point of view that Tacitus, the historian, in reviewing the first century in Judea, says under Tiberius in the first century in Judea and Jerusalem, nothing happened. And what he is saying is there was nothing significant that happened in the first century. Now, in Judea. Now, crucifixion, as we said before, was a Roman practice, had no real place in Jewish law, but it had a special significance for the Jew. So let's add another point about crucifixion, and that is its significance for the Jew. The law did not provide for crucifixion, but it was significant, very significant to the Jew. And the significance of crucifixion to the Jew was simply this. An idolater or blasphemer was hanged on a gibbet. So an idolater or a blasphemer who was put to death was hanged on a gibbet, a cross. Now, the thing that is, and that's out of the Old Testament law, the thing that is different about that in Roman crucifixion is, in Roman crucifixion, the cross was the means of putting the person to death. To the Jew, when you hang a person on a cross, it is after they have already died, and the intent of it was to underscore the fact that this person was under the curse of God. So to a Jew, the hanging of the body after the person was already dead, hanging the body on a cross was a special sign that they died under the curse of God. Put that in short, the Jews, when they said, "Crucify the Lord," are simply saying this: we will be satisfied with nothing in this man's death than to have him die under the curse of God himself. Now, where do we get that? Go back to Deuteronomy chapter 21. Deuteronomy 21. And notice it was not a means of execution, it was a means of disgrace. The Jews are not saying kill him, they are saying we want him killed in utter disgrace. Chapter 21, verse 22 of Deuteronomy. And if a man has committed a sin worthy of death, and he is put to death, and the Jewish method, of course, would be by stoning. He is put to death, and you hang him on a tree. In other words, that's the way you dispose of the corpse. And so their thinking was, he's committed a sin worthy of death. We're going to execute him by stoning. And then when he is dead, we're going to hang him. And of course, as you can see, the hanging is not the way they executed him. It was the way they disposed of the body. Now, what did that say? Verse 23, his corpse shall not hang all night on the tree. but you shall surely bury him on the same day, for he who is hanged is accursed of God, so that you do not defile your land, which the Lord gives you as an inheritance. In other words, they are saying, we will be happy with nothing less than death in an agonizing crucifixion, plus the message that this man is under the curse of God. And thus, that's the word on crucifixion. Now, let's go back to where we stopped. Chapter 15, verse 12. Answering them again, Pilate was saying to them, "Then what shall I do with him whom you call King of the Jews?" And they shouted back, "Crucify him." And Pilate was saying to them, "Why, what evil has he done?" And they shouted all the more, "Crucify him." And wishing to satisfy the multitude, notice the motive of Pilate is not sympathy for Jesus, but wishing to satisfy the multitude, Pilate released Barnabas for them. And after having Jesus scourged, he delivered him to be crucified. We went over some of the aspects of scourging in our last study. Let me review them very quickly. The scourging was done with an instrument called a flagellum, which was a long leather belt embedded with either bone or glass or lead of some type. The reason being, the purpose of scourging was not welts. It was not to sting. The purpose of the scourging was to tear flesh. And the basic distinction is that a good scourging always leaves the flesh hanging in shreds. It inevitably was the prelude to crucifixion. I mentioned well over half of the cases that I have read about as far as the lashing is concerned died during the flogging. Josephus says he personally witnessed a scourging where he saw internal organs exposed. The procurator Albinus had a prophet scourged until all of his bones were visible. So a scourging was a horrible thing. It was often done on the way to the cross. Now, coming out of that, we get to Mark 15, verse 16, the mockery. Event number 11, mockery. Oh, by the way, crucifixion wasn't half the pain of the cross. That was all minimal compared to what he really suffered as far as the cross is concerned, and we'll get to that later. All right, the first thing to say about the mockery, which is in verses 16 through 20, and let's read it, says the soldiers took him away into the palace, that is the praetorium, and they called together the whole Roman cohort, and they dressed him up in purple. After weaving a crown of thorns, they put it on him. Can you imagine a garment being over the flesh that has just been torn in shreds? Any garment, if it was a heavy Roman garment, could possibly be wool, and you place that over bare flesh. That had to be agonizing. So they dressed him up in purple after weaving a crown of thorns and put it on him. And they began to acclaim him, "Hail, King of the Jews," and they kept beating his head with a reed, spitting at him and kneeling down before them. And after that they had mocked him, they took the purple off him, put his garments on him, and they led him out to crucify him. So the first thing we'll say about the mockery is this stands out, this treatment, as a unique feature of Jesus' crucifixion. Mockery was not a normal procedure. For example, in a normal procedure, everything has been what many others had experienced. The beating, that was normal procedure. Lots of other people had been through this. The interesting thing is, of all the records of crucifixion that have been left in Roman literature, there is no record left of anyone who was crucified ever going through this kind of mockery. They didn't do that. That was not part of the normal procedure. Therefore, this is unique to Jesus. And it is simply saying this: Jesus suffered
in to an extent and in a manner. Jesus suffered. Now, I'm just talking about physically now. Jesus suffered physically. To an extent and in a manner. To an extent and in a manner without parallel. In other words, you can come up with other accounts where the prisoner was scourged. You can come up with other accounts where the Roman trial was the same. The procedures were followed. Carrying his cross, that was a matter of record. That was not unusual. This is unique. And again, it is pointing out that normally it was scourging, crucifixion. With Jesus, it was scourging, mockery, and then crucifixion. The second thing to say about the mockery is the verbs in verse 19. The verbs and similar action words in chapter 15 and verse 19 are all durative. Durative means repeated. It's simply saying this thing went on and on and on. So that when we, and again our translation has done a good job with it down at verse 19, at least the New American Standard has done, says they kept beating his head with a reed, durative verb, and they kept spitting on him, and repeatedly kneeling, and repeatedly bowing down before him, all in mockery. And when you see in verse 19, they kept beating his head with a reed, the other accounts point out that in the mockery of Jesus, they do three things. Number one, they give him a purple robe. Number two, they put a crown of thorns on his head. And number three, since he's the king, let's give him a scepter. That was the reed. Now, can you picture the indignity? Picture a king on his throne. And he holds forth his scepter. And someone comes up to him, grabs the scepter out of his hand, and smashes him in the face with it. What kind of indignity is involved in that? And that's exactly what happens. They give him the reed, and they come up and grab it out of his hand and slash him with his reed of authority. Since the reed of the king, or the scepter of the king, was indicative of his authority and power, when they strike him in the face with it, what are they doing? You don't have any authority. You don't have any power whatsoever. And again, that is the aspect that we're looking about in this particular particular mocking that takes place here. Well, with that then, verse 20, they conclude the mockery and they lead him out to crucify him. And we've said some things about the crucifixion, but let's outline the little section. And basically, with the crucifixion, we'll break it into two parts. Event number 12. Now, keep in mind the accomplishments of the cross as far as salvation of men is concerned. And keep in mind those profound words of Tacitus. In the first century, Judea and Jerusalem, nothing of significance happened. Okay, we're coming now to Golgotha. And then at Golgotha. To Golgotha, 21 through 20 and 22. Verse 21. 20, rather. What 21? It says, they pressed into service a passerby coming from the country, Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus, that he might bear his cross. And they brought him to the place Golgotha, which is translated the place of the skull. First of all, we know several things that are involved when it says, they led him out to be crucified, because there was a procedure followed in the route they took to the place of execution. The route of the crucifixion was determined by one rule, and the one rule is this: you go through the busiest streets of the city. And the prisoner is to carry his transverse bar on the way to the crucifixion. And often, they would scourge them on the way. That's a little bit different. Jesus was scourged, then went to the cross. Usually, the scourging took place on the way as the prisoner attempted to carry his cross. And thus, the whole message was this. We want you to take the route where the most people will see, because we want to keep the population intimidated. And thus, the route was significant. The route to the place of execution was determined by maximum exposure. Was determined to gain maximum exposure to the population. It was a reminder that you don't play with Rome. The prisoner, again, carried his crossbar. And again, don't take a picture of the typical artist picture with the cross that's like this, and Jesus has got his shoulder on the transverse bar and he's dragging the cross. That's not an accurate picture at all of what is there. He's carrying the transverse bar to which he will be attached, which in turn will be attached to the vertical bar that was already placed in the ground. All right, the route was significant. We now come, and we'll label this at Golgotha, 23-32. And the first thing that is called our attention is the offer of the wine, verse 23. It says they tried to give him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. Now, if you come at this from the standpoint of the Jew, this was a humane thing. Giving someone who was going to be executed, especially crucified, something strong to drink to relieve the pain was based on Proverbs chapter 31, verse 6. So this was a Jewish practice, usually carried out by the older women. And it was a Jewish practice based on Proverbs 31, 6 and 7. And so, doubtless, some of the Jewish women coming out of the book of Proverbs, chapter 31, verses 6 and 7. This is why they did what they did from the Old Testament perspective. Verse 6 says, "Give strong drink to him who is perishing, and wine to him whose life is bitter. Let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his trouble no more." And based on that, you have the action coming down in Mark chapter 15 and verse 23. Doubtless the Jewish women, coming off of the advice of Proverbs, tried to give him some wine mixed with myrrh. We do have an interesting note. There was a physician named Pedanius in the first century who studied some 600, and he leaves records on this, he studied some 600 plants and 1,000 drugs available at that time, and concluded that the best narcotic quality came from myrrh mixed with wine. So that the obvious attempt here is to desensitize Jesus to some extent by the offer of the wine. Next, we have the remark about the clothing. And the clothing comes down to verses 24-25. They crucified him, divided up his garments among themselves, casting lots for them. Jewish law, or rather Roman law, provided that the executioners had the right to the small goods that the person crucified had. So they cast lots for them to decide what he should take. Then it was a third hour when they crucified him, and we then move to past the wine and the garments to the inscription. And once again, Roman history helps us a little bit to understand the inscription. This was common practice now. Verse 26, the inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." What happened was this. On the way to crucifixion, the prisoner not only carried the transverse bar of the cross, but he was also given a board on which the charge for which he is being put to death was carried. So the victim carried a board on which the charge was written. And you can see how that would be calculated as he went through the city and how that would affect the crowds. Charge sedition. And as he comes through the busy streets, the people would look and say, "See what happens when you revolt against Rome?" And Rome felt that had a very good effect on keeping order in Rome. When the prisoner or the victim arrived at the place of execution, was placed on the cross, the charge was then placed over his head. So he carried the board on which the charge was written, and then it was affixed over his head when he was crucified. Both Pliny and Suetonius, I'm quoting Suetonius, says, after the victim was placed on the cross, the board containing the charge was placed over his head. Now, when that happened, and it's a little aside, Paul in the book of Colossians says there was another sign that was also over the head of Jesus. And it also contained a true charge of guilt. And whenever we think of that, we ought to think of Colossians 2 and verse 14. Because not only was the charge of being guilty of insurrection over his head, but Paul points out that there was something else over that cross. Colossians chapter 2. And it is the way we should always think of what was over the cross. Chapter 2, verse 14 speaks of his death and says, having canceled out the certificate of death consisting of decrees against us, which was hostile to us, and he has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross. So Paul says the other inscription over the cross was a listing of my sins that said you deserve to die. And with the charges against me, by his cross, he took them out of the way. Beautiful expression of the substitutionary aspect of the salvation provided by Christ on the cross. Now, we notice that the cause of death frequently in crucifixion was exhaustion, but we need to take a little look and list some of the aspects in which the death of Christ differed from other crucifixions. We've had similarities. So let's put it in the form of the question, how was Jesus' crucifixion different? We've looked at how it was the same. Now, how was it different? What was unique about the crucifixion of Jesus? Number one, I don't think we indicated before, that if you wanted to prolong death 6-7 days, the person would often be tied to the cross, so they wouldn't bleed to death. If you wanted a more painful death, quicker, then they would use the nails. If, however, for some reason you wanted to terminate them even quicker yet, then a Roman soldier would take an iron club and break the bones. For example, look back at chapter 19 of John, or over to John 19, 31 through down to verse 36, really. Verse 31. At the crucifixion of Jesus, there was a desire to speed things up. And in verse 31, it says, the Jews, therefore, because it was the day of preparation, so that the body should not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for the Sabbath was a high day, asked Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. The soldiers therefore came, broke the legs of the first man and of the other man who was crucified with them. But coming to Jesus, when they saw that he was already dead, did not break his legs. And again, behind that, we have the fulfillment of Scripture in verse 36 coming out of the Old Testament, which reads, "For these things came to pass, that the Scripture might be fulfilled, not a bone of him shall be broken." And that comes again from the Old Testament. So then, in first place at which the death of Jesus was different from the other two is his bones were not broken. Those of the other two were. The second thing that is unique about the death of Jesus was the cause of death was not bleeding to death. The cause of death was not exhaustion. The cause of death was totally under his control. Or the time of death. Was under control. Can you imagine reading a death certificate and the cause of death is stated as he voluntarily said to his spirit, "Go." Cause of death. Go over to Matthew chapter 27:50. Jesus died the only voluntary death that has ever been died. That anyone has ever died. Ever been died. That anyone has ever died. You say, well, when a person commits suicide, aren't they voluntarily taking their life? No. Because they are choosing, and they put the gun to their head, and they can still stop, can't they? They pull the trigger. And just as the hammer falls on the bullet, they say, oh, I've changed my mind. Or when the bullet gets halfway through their head, they change their mind and say, I don't want to do this. No one has ever died a totally voluntary death. There's always a point before death when you can't help it. There's nothing you can do to reverse it. Except Christ. And before he died, he was in absolute control all the way. You see the point I'm making? Nobody has ever died of their own volition. Because there's always a point when volition can act, but now that you've swallowed the poison, you can't change your mind now. It's too late. Not so with Jesus. Jesus is the only person who ever died voluntarily. And that comes down to Matthew chapter 27 and verse 50. It says, "And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit." The word "yielded up" is the Greek word aphiemi. And let me give you the first basic meaning of the word aphiemi. If you would look it up, A-P-H-I-A-M-I, I suppose, in English. If you would look up the first meaning, aphiemi means to send away, not yield up. So verse 50 really says, Jesus cried out with a loud voice and sent his spirit away, and he died. That was the death of the cross. Now, as much as we have emphasized in this passage the suffering of the cross, and we ought to, let's note a third thing about the death of Jesus that is unique. His bones were not broken. The time of death and the cause of death was totally under control. Really, from the perspective of how he died, he didn't die of crucifixion. The cross did not kill him. He terminated with his own volition, commending his spirit into the hands of his Father. The last thing we'll say about his death that makes it unique is this. The physical suffering, was minimal when compared to the spiritual suffering, or when compared to Mark 15:34. The physical suffering was minimal when compared to Mark 15:34, and let's turn to it and read it and close. Mark 15:34. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, and again in Aramaic, which is translated, and here is the cross, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And that takes us to the climax of suffering, which was the spiritual separation from his Father, which was on behalf of our sins in order to gain our salvation. Father, we're thankful tonight for the love of God the Father that is expressed in the death of Jesus Christ, that being put to death by the very human race that also brought about the salvation of man. And we are thankful and we pray that we will appreciate the suffering of Christ on our behalf in His name.